Good afternoon. So last time we talked about how modern processors really work. We learned that modern processors did these two things beyond just being a pipeline processor. They executed multiple instructions at the same time, including fetching multiple instructions at the same time and decoding multiple instructions at the same time and actually doing the arithmetic for multiple instructions at the same time. And they also executed these instructions out of order. They looked at when operands were actually available and used that to decide what instructions to actually run. We had this idea that there's something like a queue, we call it an instruction queue, where we take things off the queue based on whether they're ready or not. So we have some logic to track when instructions are ready, and we have forwarding, which somehow uses this queue instead of the type of forwarding we learned in our pipeline processor. And this dramatically changes how we have to think about optimizations, because the performance is determined not by how long does each instruction take to run, but by the order in which you can run instructions and whether you can take advantage of having multiple copies of execution units like ALUs. And an abstraction we could use to analyze programs with this in mind was something called the data flow model, where we decided that we're going to look at each of the operations, which typically is one instruction, but maybe something else. But each of these fundamental operations, which gets put on an execution unit, like an addition or a load or a store. And we're going to draw a graph where these operations are the nodes and the edges are the dependencies between the operations, where typically by dependency we mean you need the result of one operation to start the next. Like you need to add these two values and then you need to multiply the result of that addition. You have to do the add first, then the multiply. And looking at this data flow graph can give us a better idea of how a modern processor will execute something and lets us have these quick bounds on performance. We have this notion of a latency bound. And that's from, if we have the data flow graph, it shows us where the dependencies are. And in order to execute whatever we're showing with our data flow graph, we need to finish the longest dependency chain. We need to do that one after the other. So by looking at the amount of time that sequence of operation takes, we know a lower bound in how much time our processor needs to execute. And this was useful for telling us why, for example, when we did more and more loop unrolling, we hit some wall in performance that was precisely based on this analysis, because we had this sequence of things which had to be done one after the other. And it didn't matter that we could do more arithmetic per unit time. And based on this observation, we had a key optimization we talked about, which was multiple accumulators, that instead of adding to, say, a single value over and over and over again, we would have multiple values we'd add to, and then we'd have to fix up and combine the results at the end. And what this did is it made our data flow graph flatter. Previously, our data flow graph had this very long chain, you know, whereas if you're drawing the graph, say, going down, it would be very tall. And by having multiple accumulators, we sort of split things up into two smaller chains, which join at the end. And so our dependency graph is less tall, and we have more parallelism. Conceptually, if we have enough ALUs, we look at, say, a row across that graph, we can do all of those things at the same time, assuming we have the hardware to do it. And modern processors often, but not always, do. We also talked about some miscellaneous optimizations. So you mentioned that there are things that compilers do, which for the most part you don't need to worry about, but you can control whether or not that happens. And one example was for dividing by a constant. Well, the division instruction is really slow. And compilers know this, so they'll turn division into something else. And sometimes this can be some weird multiplication by, you know, which happens to have the math work out. And we're not going to have you figure out how to do that exactly, but you know, if you want the compiler to do that for you, well, you're going to need to have it know that it's a constant. So either by having a hard-coded number or having like a const int you've declared and assigned in a header file, the compiler needs to know that. And we had similar sorts of issues with address calculations in loop. So when we've shown like our cache blocking code, we've typically, as the code is written, do this pretty complicated calculation to figure out, say, what element of A we're accessing. We have, you know, I times N plus J. You know, we do that every cycle. And that's not actually what you want the processor to end up doing, because you know, it's a multiplication for every load. You know, we're doing a lot of work just to compute where in the array to access. And compilers know this, and it's common to see code with that kind of pattern. So they have these ways of transforming those address calculations into something simpler, where typically they would just increment, you know, a pointer by a single number that they could pre-compute, and they could just do this between cycles rather than doing a multiply and things like that. And it's useful to know about this because, well, if you happen to write code where the compiler can't do it, it's going to be surprising. Suddenly, my address calculation, which was previously like two instructions, is now like three or four, and one of them is a multiply, which takes three cycles of latency. You know, suddenly my program becomes slower, even though my C code maybe didn't change that much. And also because if you want to make sure this happens, like if the compiler doesn't do it, you might want to write it by hand. Or at least think about how you can write your code so it's easy for the compiler to transform it like this. Okay, so any questions about any of these topics before we go on to talk about vector instructions, which we started last time? So, vector instructions, we learned that modern processors have these big registers, these 128-bit registers on 64-bit x86. We'll learn that goes beyond that. And they happen to be named XMM0 through XMM15. And we have these instructions that act on all the values in the register. So, for example, this is a add four 32-bit numbers instructions. And it acts on all the values in the sense that we take a pair of values from each register and put it in our result. A pair, put in the result. A pair, put in the result. So I'll talk about this being like we're doing vertical sums. So if you lay out the values underneath each other, we're summing each column. And so each of these four sum operations is independent. We're just specifying them all together and, you know, using the same amount of space in our program, basically, as if we were specifying one of them. And so here's an example, which I believe I ended on last time, of code that my compiler, I think this was Clang with the appropriate optimization settings to make this happen, generated. So notice a few things. So this is a case where it's easy for the compiler to generate these vector instructions. And I've done a couple things to make sure that's true. So one thing is I use this restrict keyword. You may remember I said that the restrict keyword says, I promise these don't alias. And this is one of the few cases I've seen where it actually does something. Usually I haven't had it happen. In this case, it actually does something. Because the compiler generated code which loads four elements from A and four elements from B, and then writes those four things to A at a time. And if A and B overlap, that's wrong. Because writing A of 0 might change B of 1, and so you can't write A of 0 and A of 1 at the same time if they overlap like that. So the compiler knows because of the restrict keyword that that didn't happen. That's why it could generate this nice clean assembly. If it didn't know that, it would either need not to use vector instructions like this or to generate a comparison to check, do these overlap? And so we have this code with vector instructions. So we have this move DQU, which loads into one of these XMM0 registers. So that loads four values from A and four values from B. We use RDI and RSI, or A and B, the pointers. And we have RAX, which is a counter which is kept in bytes to where we are in each of the arrays. Because it's a counter in bytes, we're doing four elements at a time. We increment it by 16 because each of the elements is 4 bytes. So 16 bytes is the size of 4 of them. So we load 4 from A, 4 from B. We add them together. And then we store them back into A. and that's each iteration of the loop. And because I conveniently told my compiler that this loop has exactly 128 iterations, and it was easy for it to figure that out, we compare it to 512, which is 4 times 128, to know if the loop is done. And we don't deal with any cases for what if I had a non-multiple of 4 number of iterations. Compiler knows at compile time it's a multiple of 4. If it didn't, well, it would need to generate some code after this loop that handled the leftover, like we saw with loop unrolling. And probably it would handle the leftover without using the vector instructions, because the vector instruction is add 4 values and store 4 values. There's not a 3 option. So any questions about this code? Yes. What is rep return? Rep return is basically the same as return. It behaves slightly differently with respect to branch prediction on some processors. And it has a different size, which might matter for some things. Yes?
So the QU, the move DQU,
yes.
Yes.
So DQU and UPS are essentially just the size specifiers, like we had move Q. Like they're equivalent to Q. DQU is basically equivalent to that. What it actually stands for, so in each of these cases, are that DQU is double quad word. And a word is 16 bits, so double quad word is 16 times 8 bits is 128 bits. And the U stands for unaligned. So there's two versions of these instructions. One of them requires alignment, meaning that the address you move from has to be a multiple of 16. And this makes it easier to implement as far as caches, because we're only going to access one cache block. Whereas with the unaligned version, we might have to access two. It turns out on modern processors, they aren't actually different in performance. If you stay within a cache block, it's faster, yes, but it doesn't change the performance. But there's two versions of the instruction, because historically that wasn't the case. And UPS stands for unaligned packed single precision floats, which, yes, seems non-intuitive, but it's saying that you're storing floating point numbers, but it's the same registers, so it doesn't matter. Like, it's still 128 bits worth of stuff. We don't care what it is, we're just moving bits to memory. Like, we can use an instruction that's meant for floating point numbers for that. Yeah, your question? When the question is, when you use restrict on a parameter, does that mean your promise doesn't alias anything else? Yes. There are much more precise rules in the C standard as for what that means, because there's obvious questions of what does anything else mean? But essentially, you're saying everywhere I use this pointer, I'm not also using things it aliases with. But there's much more precise rules in the C standard about what other things might you're saying don't alias. Other questions about this code? Okay. So pictorially, what's happening here is, as we're going through the loop, we load 4 elements of A, B, and 4 elements of A into two of these registers, PID, adds them together, and we get these, as I said, vertical sums. And it's all, that load is one, each of those loads is one instruction, that add is one instruction. And you saw that, my compiler generated this. So, if this is something the compiler does, why are we spending a lot of time on it? Well, one thing is that it does affect performance. So, another example is when we were talking about cache blocking. My compiler happened to do this, but it only did it when I coaxed things to happen correctly. And we'll talk about when that does and doesn't happen. But we can see this weird thing on this graph, which is an effect of this optimization. So we have these squiggly lines. And the squiggly lines, they aren't from caches. We know that caches do have these weird cases where they have differing behavior, but that's based on conflict misses, which aren't going to happen periodically like that. What's happening here is that my compiler turned this code into code that used vector instructions to do the multiplies and additions, and it had vectors with 8 values. And these squiggles happen to be every 8 numbers. So in the case where we had exactly a multiple of 8, well, everything fit in vectors, and we didn't have any left over on each row of my matrix. In the cases where I had 7 leftover elements, I had 7 things on each row that I was doing without vectors, because my compiler had a bit of code it needed to generate it for the leftover. And that's why we get these squiggles. So the bottom, the highest performance is when everything fits perfectly in the vectors, and we have this extra overhead for when it doesn't. Questions about this? Okay, so this is, visible effects. So let's talk about implementation. So I alluded that basically what modern processors that implement vector instructions do is that they just have more copies of the ALU. So conceptually, we can say that if we have an ALU for a vector instruction, that execution unit is basically 4 copies of an ALU. And we'll say that each one is for what we'll call a lane. We'll call each of those values we're adding, each of those columns, a lane. So we have one ALU per lane, and it's just copied, and this collectively is our vector ALU. It can do an operation on the whole vector. And just like the ALUs we saw before, this might be pipelined. So here, if I had my naive ALU, where I could only do one operation and I have to wait for it to go all the way through before I started another one, I do one operation, every 3 cycles. And with this design, now I'm doing, assuming I can use vector instructions, 12 times the work per cycle, assuming I can keep the pipeline full. So you might say, if processors are implementing it this way, why didn't they just duplicate the normal ALUs? Like, that's more flexible, and we wouldn't have to have compilers generate different code that like checked for aliasing and all that. Might be better just to like have more ALUs. Why don't compilers do that? Any guesses as to like what's the disadvantage of just duplicating the ALU versus having something like this where we have one ALU with just all these lanes that all have to do the same thing and take things from one instruction? Why do we want this less flexible design? Why did the Intel not decide to just add more normal ALUs? Why did they decide to basically add more hardware in this form where they just make their ALU wider? So the thing to think about is when we talked about an out-of-order processor, we had to talk about our instruction queue, and it needed to like keep track of what instructions were ready. We also needed to do all the forwarding. We need to know when an instruction finished. We need to send it its values. So we have lots and lots of logic which is not dedicated to computation. And in fact, if you think of some simple operation like addition, there's a lot more of this logic involved in executing the instruction than actually involved in doing the addition. And you kind of saw a hint of this when you implemented the pipeline processor for homework, right? There's a lot of logic you had to implement when you added pipelining that didn't do any computations. You did a whole bunch of comparisons and all that. And with these out-of-order processors, that's way, way worse. And it gets bad enough that vector instructions are attractive because when you add these vector instructions, when you do this to your ALU, Well, your control logic didn't change very much. Yes, you added a few registers, but essentially you're doing the same thing you'd do if those were normal instructions that added one value at a time. But in exchange, you've gotten a lot more computational capacity for not very much extra stuff on your CPU, because you know you don't have any extra stuff in your instruction queue, basically, and so on. So you actually made your processor a lot faster, assuming compilers and programmers will actually use these extra instructions. And this has been the direction that Intel and most processor manufacturers have been going to sort of get more computation out of their processors. They've decided that trying to make the out-of-order execution do more, because it makes the control logic so much more complicated, and it's already really, really complicated, though they don't really want to make it bigger, so they're adding these special instructions, and that's how they're adding more capacity to compute things to their chips. And just to give perspective on the control logic, so like on a modern processor, the control logic, that instruction queue has like order 160 entries. And every cycle, we need to somehow figure out which of those 160 entries is ready to run. And like that, so that gets really, you know, there's lots of logic involved in making that work. I guess instruction queue might be the wrong word. The instruction queue plus reorder buffer collectively have like order 160 entries. Yes?
What's an entry?
Entry meaning one instruction, basically.
Oh.
It's a little more complicated than that because the instructions are translated to a slightly different kind of instructions. So like, for example, an add that accesses memory will usually turn into access memory then add as separate operations. But yeah, but this logic is incredibly complicated for an out-of-order processor because they want to have hundreds of instructions in flight. So they need to have a data structure which can store a list of 100 instructions that might not have finished yet. Yeah, I guess the pending instruction part might be a little smaller than that, but it's still like over 60 at least instructions that it has to choose from. And if you wanted to like make that four times bigger, well, it turns out you're going to be spending most of your hardware space not on arithmetic. But adding vector instructions, you make it four times bigger, you're spending most of your space on actual arithmetic. Okay, so I showed you that compilers have sort of met up to this challenge that processor manufacturers made, that saying, if you want the performance, you need to use vector instructions. Sometimes they will figure out how to do it. And they've been getting much better over the past decade or so, decade or two. But they're very fickle. Basically, what compilers are typically doing to use vector instructions is they recognize certain patterns, and if your code matches that pattern, they will know how to make it use vector instructions. And if you happen to do something which doesn't match that pattern, or which they can't prove matches that pattern, they won't. So aliasing messes them up, because, well, first step of using vector instructions is to make sure you can do four things at once, or eight things, depending on the size of the vectors. And that means you need to know that like each thing doesn't depend on each other. Conditionals messes it up. If you think of having a loop where you do, you have a for loop, and inside the loop you have, you know, if something, then you do a plus equals, let's say, and otherwise you do a minus equals. Well, we want to generate vector instructions for this. You might say, let's do the vector add or the vector subtract. Well, that doesn't really work because the vector add is add four values. It's not add one, three, and four. And the vector subtract is subtract four values, not subtract, you know, some subset of them. So conditionals are really problematic for the compiler to deal with. And like you can do it by hand, but it's not trivial to figure out how to make it fast with conditionals. You can't just do the straightforward thing like we saw with that add loop. Not every operation has a vector instruction. So for example, integer division does not have a vector instruction on x86-64. If you want to do integer division of 4 in, for integers, what the compiler would have to do is copy each one into a normal register, use the normal integer division instruction, and then copy it back. That is, there's no instruction to do that. And that works on the vector registers. And there's some other operations which are that way. So, as an illustration of just how fickle compilers are about figuring out whether or not to use vector instructions, for this first piece of code, GCC 7.2 and Clang 5.0, with the appropriate aggressive optimization arguments, -03 for GCC, -02 or -0 for Clang, will generate vector instructions for this. They will turn that loop into one which does, in this case, on with 128-bit registers, four things at once. And for the second one, which only differs in the loop order, they won't. And it's not that the second one can't be vectorized. You may notice that, differs in the loop order and this element here, index here. You may notice that, well, we're accessing K sequentially, so we're accessing consecutive things in A here. So that should be easy to deal with. Like, we can load a contiguous chunk of A into 128 bits, that's four values from each of these references to A. So, like, it's actually not hard to vectorize, but the compiler just didn't figure it out. And the problem is that it didn't figure out how to deal with this part. And it's just because it was missing a pattern at the time, maybe that will be fixed in the future. But this is not intuitive. Like, there's only minor changes between these two pieces of code, and there's nothing like conceptually breaking vectorization. It's just that the compilers don't have patterns for what we're doing here, and probably the thing they're missing a pattern for is I'm adding into the same value repeatedly. And maybe they'll add that in some future version such that they can figure this out. But this is just an unfortunate thing you'll discover when you try to get compilers to do this. And this is a big issue for you as someone trying to make code fast, because this makes the compiler seem like crazy. Like, you make a little change to your code and suddenly it gets way, way faster or way, way slower. And that's something you'll see if you have optimization options that include vectorization. And as another example of the sort of things you find, so Clang 5.0.0 generated vector instructions for the top and not the bottom. The only difference is whether n is an int or a long. I'm sure this is a bug, but this is, again, because they're doing pattern matching. Like, if you don't fit the pattern, they might not know how to do vector instructions for it. They'll still generate code, it just won't be as fast. And as a concrete example, concrete message about the performance assignments, we've deliberately set compiler flags which don't do vector instructions to keep things consistent, not because this is what you should do if you want maximum performance. Just so you don't get surprised and you have to, like, because we don't want people to like randomly hit what the compiler optimizes and some people not to. So if you can't rely on the compiler doing it, what are your alternatives if you want to make sure vector instructions happen? So there are basically two big options we can talk about. So one is that we've seen the assembly for these vector instructions. You could write the assembly by hand. Like, that's certainly an option, and you know what you might need to do to make this happen. There's an option which is easier than that, which is going to be called intrinsic functions. So these are C functions provided in your compiler that compile basically to a particular instruction. And these will always be inline, so there's no function call really. It's just a way of telling the compiler, please execute this instruction here. Like, please move 128 bits from here into something. So especially something that looks like a function call, but will compile to that move 128 bits instruction. And similarly, something that looks like a function call, but will compile into add two arrays of value, vectors of values together and produce a vector. And Intel defines a set of these for its processors. So Intel defines a set of what they call intrinsic functions with names which are the same across basically all compilers that for the Intel processors that you can use that will translate directly to particular instructions. And this is what we're going to have you use for the smooth homework. So that you're going to need to have the code use vectors, and you're going to have to write it using these intrinsic functions. So I'm going to show an example of what using these intrinsic functions to explicitly specify I want to use vector operations looks like. Before I do that, I should note that Intel has some very, very poor choices in naming. And I'm sorry I can't do much about it, but they just have some very bad choices in naming. So here's some code. So Intel has chosen to name most of its intrinsic functions starting with underscore mm. And they've chosen to name the types they use starting with underscore underscore m and something. Presumably the leading underscore is because they were really concerned about breaking code that included their header file. And they didn't want to do it, so they just made sure the names were hopefully something no one would be using. And we have both types and these functions. And we also have some weird names in the functions. I'll get to that in a second. So we have this special type, underscore underscore m128i. So there's three types you'll deal with to represent a 128-bit register. And these types, they all represent the same thing in the hardware, slightly like you can cast between them. But we have different ones to help you remember what kind of values is supposed to be in that 128-bit value. So underscore underscore m128i means it's 128 bits of integers. We don't specify what kind of integers. So it could be 64-bit integers, 4 32-bit integers, and so on. Like, we all will use the same type for them until they didn't decide to subdivide the types that much. There's also underscore underscore m128 with nothing, that means floats, and with d, that means double. So a note about these types, that on GCC, if you do a values of 0, it will compile. You should not do it. Don't do it. Because this type doesn't tell you what size of the things inside it are. GCC has made an arbitrary choice about what a values of 0 does. If you want to extract something, you should use a particular intrinsic function that will do it. You want to extract 0, 1, 2, or 3. And you can look those up in the documentation we will provide you for the lab next week, and that will be linked from the smooth homework. But you should not do that array indexing, even though it might compile, because you don't know what size GCC is assuming it contains. And it might disagree with the size you are trying to make it contain, because it just the type just means it's some kind of integers. Okay, so the first thing we do here is we load values from A and from B, starting at address of A at index I and the B at index I. So we're passing that address and we're converting it to a pointer to 128 bits of integers. So that means that we're providing a pointer to not just one value, but four values, because we have 32-bit integers. And we're loading all four of those values together. And this load u SI128 function does that. So the load part, that makes sense. The u and the SI128 make a little less sense. So SI128 basically stands for 128-bit integer value, probably signed integer 128. As I alluded to before, like, it's 128 bits of data. It doesn't matter what type you say it is, even if it generates different instructions, because it's 128 bits in a register. You don't care, you know, what type the processor thought it was when it was loading it. And the u means unaligned, this is to choose between the versions of the instructions which require the address to be a multiple of 16 bits and the ones which don't. We'll just always use the unaligned ones. On the machines we use, there's no speed benefit to using the other ones. And similarly, we have store, which serves the value back. So we provide the same address, same part of A. So we're specifying four elements of A, starting with AI. So AI, AI plus one, I plus two. And we're storing the values in sums, which is another 128-bit thing, which in this case represents four integers. We also have to do the actual addition. So here we have our four values from A and our four values from B, and we end up adding each pair together. And we have a function that corresponds to the PADD instruction I showed you earlier, and its name is addEPI32. So the add part, pretty obvious. The EPI32 part, not intuitive at all. So EPI32 is going to mean four 32-bit integers. Generally, EPI blank means enough blank to fit 128 bits. You might ask, why EPI? So the name comes from extended packed integers. Why extended? So there was an earlier version of these vector instructions which had 64-bit vectors, and those were called packed integers, and they wanted to share the same name, so they called them an extended packed integers for the 128-bit version. Yes?
What is the type of sum?
What is the type of sums? It is this underscore underscore M128i, this 128 bits of integers. That's the return type. So this function takes two of those M128i's and returns an M128i. That's what its prototype is. Any questions about this code? So this is just the explicit version of that code I showed you my compiler generating before. Here I've just very explicitly written out what I expect, what I want to happen with vectors. And this is what I would need to do if my compiler for some reason couldn't figure out to do that. This would probably be the easiest way to make sure it happens. Notice that I'm avoiding a bunch of the annoyance of writing assembly. Like, I didn't need to worry about what's caller or callee saved. I didn't need to worry about writing the address calculations correctly. All that stuff that some of you may have run into trouble with on the loop lab, for example. But I still got the benefit of these vector instructions, and probably the compiler will generate essentially the same assembly I would have written by hand, but it would have taken more time. So the vector instructions have versions for different sizes. So I showed you PADD. We have actually lots of extra instructions they need to add. So in addition to PID, there's one for adding 64-bit values. So here's the 64-bit version. So what we changed is we don't increment I by 4, we increment it by 2, because we want to go 128 bits at a time, because that's what we're loading. And in this case, 120 bits is two values, two longs. Whereas previously we had ints. And we adding 64-bit values, not 32-bit values. So we use EPI64, means two 64-bit integers, not enough 64-bit integers to fill 128 bits. We're adding two pairs of integers instead of four pairs of smaller integers. And something you may notice that's kind of an inconvenient thing about these vector instructions is that to support these different sizes, well, they had to add a whole lot of instructions. So we have like a version of the add instruction for bytes, 16-bit values, 32-bit values, 64-bit values, and multiply, and subtract, and so on. We have a lot of instructions needed to implement this, more so than you conceptually need for normal single registers, because we want to support different sized values. and it makes a bigger difference than with normal registers, where if you only had 64-bit add instructions and didn't have these 16-bit ones, you wouldn't care very much because, well, you know, it's you have to use the register anyways. You basically can't put anything else in it. But with these, we really do care. You know, if we can use 16-bit values, that's going to be a lot faster than if we use 32-bit, because we're doing twice as much work per instruction. Okay, so we've seen examples of what our vectorized code ends up looking like. But we actually want to be able to, well, produce this code, and usually we're not going to have something as simple as this add example. With this add example, conveniently, what we're doing is obviously exactly what this add EPI function that Intel provides us and the corresponding instructions, the PADD instructions, do. It's like basically the same thing, just multiple times. But often, our code is not going to be like that. Like, here we have square. Remember our old square function? You know, we're doing something repeatedly. We have things that we should be able to do in parallel, like most of these iterations of the innermost loop are independent of each other, so you can do them in parallel. But it's less clear how to actually use the vector instructions for this. In particular, we're not just adding, you know, consecutive pairs of values. Like, in some cases, we have, you know, the same value repeated. In some cases, we have consecutive values. And we have that mix, and we need this to actually work out. So what procedure should you do to actually take something like this and manually turn it into code that uses vector instructions? So the first thing you want to do is, since we know we have 32-bit values, we know our vectors store four values, I want to get this into groups of four things that are basically all the same operations. Because we're going to need to do four independent adds and four independent multiplies is the goal. And each of those four independent multiplies, we're going to do with one instruction. Those four independent adds, we're going to do with one instruction. So first, I'm going to unroll this loop to expose that. So now I have four lines, each of which has a multiply and an add. So it has the exact same operations. So conceptually, my goal here is going to be that, oh, I have this multiply. My goal is that this is going to be one of this a vector multiply instruction. It's going to do all these multiplies together. And this plus equals is going to be a vector add instruction that's going to do all those adds at the same time. And since I have this in a nice parallel form, and I observe that the places we're writing to are different for each one, so I don't need to worry about doing these at the same time. So this is what I'm going to end up trying to turn into my vectorized code. So next thing we need to worry about is, how do I get the values I want to add and multiply into these M128 values? How do I load 128 bits? That's the appropriate 128 bits. Now, for B, we can do what we saw before. We load 128 bits at bi times n plus j, and that's going to give us four elements starting there, so plus 0, 1, 2, and 3, exactly what we want. And the same is true for this ak times n plus j. We load 128 bits there, we get the other three elements exactly what you want, happens to line up precisely the way we like. And if this didn't happen, maybe we try to rearrange the loop to make sure it did. Maybe we change the loop order a bit to help that out. Now, this part here is more problematic. We want to load ai times n plus k, and we want to have four copies of it. You know, we don't happen to have something in the array A which is four copies of it. We have one copy of it. Fortunately, this is a very common thing to want to do. It's so common, in fact, that Intel has an intrinsic for doing it. So Intel provides this set1 EPI 32. It varies what instructions this corresponds to, so this is not actually, this intrinsic function, I told you they like correspond to one instruction. That's not always true. This is like a sequence of two. But there's instructions for arranging values within a vector register. We'll talk about them a bit later. This is another part of the extra complexity. But We have this intrinsic because this is such a common operation, usually from things like this. Like, we often have times where we went to get one value, have all the copies of it, and use multiple copies of it to do a vector operation against different things. We also need to know how to multiply, and I didn't actually show you the multiply intrinsic function, and you might have guessed it's mmmul epi32. It is not. So mmmul epi, low epi32, multiplies two 32-bit values and gives you the lowest 32 bits of the results. Multiplies pairs of 32-bit values, sorry, and gives you the lowest 32 bits of results. There's also a mmul high, which multiplies pairs of 32-bit values and gives you makes 64-bit results and gives you the high 32 bits of each of those 64-bit results. And there's another version of the multiply, which multiplies two pairs of 32-bit values and gives you two 64-bit results. And the one we want is we want to do multiply 32-bit values and get a 32-bit result, so we use the one where we get the low 32 bits. That's where the low in the name comes from. And that corresponds to an instruction pmul ld, l for low, d for 32-bit values. Okay, so given that we have these intrinsics, we now know how to do every operation we need to do. We know how to load and store the values in B and A, both the case where we want to get four consecutive values in the original array and we want to get four copies of the same value. And we also know how to do a multiply, a 32-bit multiply that produces 32-bit results, and how to do an addition we know from before. So given that, I'm going to translate this to vectorized code, and we're going to go one operation at a time. I'm not going to show the code in order. We'll put that together later. So the first thing I'm going to worry about is doing the loads and stores. So I'm just going to figure out what those look like first. So I'm going to go from left to right, or not quite. I'm going to go starting with B, because it's the thing we want to probably load store. It's the most complicated case. So our loading is we take the address of this first element here, and we know the other three are right after it. So we just provide that address. We actually are going to need a cast here. We're going to say that we have 128 bits of data starting at that address. So we're going to load that into a variable bij, which is going to have the type m128i, and we're going to change that value is by using the intrinsic function. So we're going to presumably assign bij a new value, which is the result of an app somewhere in the middle. And once we've done that, we're going to store the modified bij back into the array B by doing just the inverse of that loop. Any questions about this part? I know that what's loaded and stored is usually what confuses people most about this. Yes?
I'm sorry, so we loaded four elements from B.
Yes.
Into bij.
Yes.
Bij is a vector.
Yes, so bij will have been declared somewhere with M128IBIJ. And hopefully, in the assembly that's generated, it's going to be stored in one of the XMM registers.
So why did we put it back again?
And presumably, we're going to have some code where I say manipulate vector here, which changes BIJ.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Like assigns a new value to it. And we'll see that code later. So after we change that BIJ variable, we'll store it back. Okay, we also want to load A. Conveniently, that's also where I need to write a cast. Okay, we also want to load into A. So for A, K of J, it's again four values starting at that address. So we just use the same load. And for AI times N plus K, we're going to load four copies of one value. So I'm going to use that set one, so I just provide the integer and gives me a vector containing four copies of it. And once I have these two values, and multiply them using that MOLO instruction I told you earlier, and we get the result of the multiply. And after I do that, I'm going to add that to Bij. So I promised I'd manipulate Bij to change its value. This is how I'm going to do that. I get the result of the multiply. I add that in Bij. Remember, I'm adding four pairs of values, and I was multiplying four pairs of values. So here I'm adding each of the four elements of Bij to the corresponding multiplication result and storing the result in my temporary variable Bij, which later on I store back into B. So if we put that all together, we get this vectorized code. Any questions about this? So, as I mentioned earlier, this code, we have this special operation to take a value and put it in four places in a vector. And it turns out that when you're doing code with these vector instructions, it's very common to want to manipulate vectors and like change the order of elements. And so far, the only real way we've seen to do that sort of thing is to like store it into an array, move things around in that array using the non-vector instructions, and then store it back into a vector. And that's obviously not very nice. So there are instructions and corresponding intrinsics for doing that. And there's a lot of them. And this is called shuffling or sometimes swizzling. So here, I have an intrinsic set R EPI 32 loads 32-bit values into a vector and returns the vector. And I'm loading 10, 20, 30, 40, and this 10 is in the lowest address if I store it into an array. And there's this shuffle function, which takes this a special constant, which is computed with this macro, that tells us what order to put things in. So in this case, we're saying that the first element of y should be from index 1, so 20. The second should be from index 0, so 10. The third should be from index 3, so 40, and the fourth should be from index 2, so 30. Indexes start with 1, 0. Yes, I know that's in reverse order. Intel likes writing the vectors out from highest address first. That's what the R in set R is for, R for reversed. The normal version is highest address first, not lowest address first, even though I don't know why you'd ever want to do that as the default, but that's what Intel chose. So this is the version for 32-bit integers. There's one for bytes. So here I'm creating a vector of byte values, so 8-bit values, 10, 20, up to 160. And I'm using this shuffle where I say the first value, first byte is going to be from index 2, 0, 1, 2. It's going to be 30. The second one is from index 2, 0, 1, 2. It's going to be 30, and so on. And then the fifth one is from index 3, so 0, 1, 2, 3, that's 40, and that's why we have 40s, and so on. So using operations like this, we can specify all sorts of ways of manipulating bytes in a vector or other values in a vector. And note that even though I'm using these with four integers and 16 bytes, like I can use the shuffle EPI8 on something which I didn't originally put integers into because it's just 128 bits of data. Yes? So there are lots of, if you look up the documentation, what we'll point you to and our very brief reference of a very small subset of the instructions that we think is sufficient to do all the assignments, there are lots of more of these operations which are a little different than the sort of general pattern you see. So there's a lot of variations or special cases of these shuffles, because it turns out that there's a lot of ways you might want to move values around in vectors. There's some functions for if I have two vectors and I want to like combine the values from them in some way, well, there's ways of doing that. There's some things for doing arithmetic within a vector. So instead of having the pairs be from two different vectors, having them within one vector. And some stuff for extracting parts. So like doing the indexing operation, there's a way of, say, give me the second thing of a vector into a normal register. So we've talked about these vector instructions and these intrinsic functions. And this isn't the only way you can write code that more explicitly specifies what vector operations to do. So there are places in between relying on our compiler to just figure out our serial code and writing assembly, or providing these intrinsic functions where we're saying, basically, use this instruction right here. So one example is GCC theoretically provides vector extensions where they have a type representing a vector, but it looks more like normal C code, like you write plus instead of the add operator. I haven't used these. I don't know if GCC generates good code with them, but they exist. And they're a nice idea, mostly because, well, they don't depend on Intel's particular thing. Like, they might work with other processors' idea of vector instructions. Also, GPUs, essentially, are just machines with vector instructions. But they have a very different model for how they're programmed. So they do something where it looks like you're writing multi-threaded code. So, and each thread is a vector lane. Each thread is one of the elements of a vector. To make this convenient, so you can actually write code with like conditionals, GPUs have more hardware support for vector instructions than something like a typical x86 processor, in order to make it so you can actually write typical code that way and have it actually compile to vector stuff. But GPUs, the reason they're fast is essentially that they just do all vector instructions. They're specialized to do just vector instructions. So there are other vector instructions sets. So what I've shown you is the SSE family of vector instructions that use these 128-bit registers. Intel has actually moved on. And recent processors have AVX or AVX2, which use 256 or 512-bit registers. Obviously, that's going to be better. The reason we don't use it in this class is because Lab Unix 01, 02, and 03 don't support them. And we want to make sure that you have consistent access to the type of vector instructions we're using. The AVX instructions are, in addition to being bigger registers, are a little bit nicer than the SSE ones. And other ISAs also have some version of these vector instructions. So ARM has something called Neon, MIPS has something called MSA, PowerPC has something called UltiVector VMX. And these are all examples of vector instructions for that particular ISA, where they've added vector registers and the corresponding instructions like the ones we've seen. So like all the major processor manufacturers have done this because it's a good way of providing more computation capacity. And I note that, as I alluded to with GPUs, like the vector instructions we've seen are pretty annoying to use, and they're features the hardware can implement, which do require some sophisticated hardware support that you see in more sophisticated vector instruction sets like those on GPUs and sometimes some more recent processors. So one example is I mentioned conditionals were really bad. There's ways of having hardware support to make the conditionals more convenient to do with vector instructions, like having a way of saying add but only these values. There's ways of dealing with variable length vectors better. So you can say add, but only the first 20 values in this 32-element vector. And also the ability to load and store non-contiguous values. So like we really relied on being able to have the values next to each other or just copy one value if we had to deal with I plus n, I plus n times 2. That would be really annoying. So sometimes processors add instructions that let you load I plus n times 2 with one instruction. Obviously, implementing that instruction, given what it has to do with the cache, it has to like talk, access a lot of different cache blocks. Implementing that instruction is really complicated, but it's considered worthwhile to make vector instructions practical to use. Because there's a lot more code that can use vector instructions well if you have that sort of instruction. And some of these features are in AVX in some form on some of the processors. Okay, so our assignment that uses vector instructions, we're going to have you take the average of every 3x3 blocks of pixels in the image. Pixels are 4 1-byte values. So you might say, I'm going to use vectors of 1-byte values. No, you aren't. And the reason why is because you need to compute the average exactly. When you add up 9 pixels, it's going to be greater than 256. So you're going to need to use shorts. So you're going to have vectors of 16-bit values. This means you can fit up to 2 pixels in a vector register. So at one M128i can have up to 2 pixels worth of data. And the basic thing you're going to take advantage of is if I have a pixel 0 and pixel 1 here, I can add them together, you know, red and green separately. I can turn that code into one vector add where I have pixel 0 parts loads pixel 0, pixel 1 parts loads pixel 1. You know, it has 16-bit values. And if they're 16-bit values, I'm in fact not using all the vector registers. I'm doing 4 adds I don't care about. But this would still be faster. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, so this is what you're going to do on smooth. We have like sort of layout instructions, and there's a lab over about SIMD before that. But this is the sort of big thing we're taking advantage of, is that while we're doing these parallel adds, let's actually do them with one instruction instead of 4 instructions. You know, and ideally, you'll figure out a way of doing, you know, since this add adds 8 things, of actually using 8 of the results and not just 4 of them. But to start out, we'll just have to use 4 of them, just 1 pixel's worth, even though there's 4 other things in the vector we don't care about initially. Okay, so to conclude when I'm talking about optimization, so before I move on, questions about vector instructions. I'm not going to talk about that again today. Okay, so let's talk about optimizing real programs. So we've given you these optimization assignments where you say, you know, unroll this loop, make this function faster. That's not what you get in the real world. In the real world, you're going to get a program, they're going to say it's slow, like I click my mouse and it takes forever to respond, and you need to fix it. So what should you do? Well, you want to spend the effort where it matters. Like, if the program is spending 90% of its time reading files and you're optimizing the computation, doesn't matter how good you are at optimizing the computation, you're not really going to make an impact. If the program spends 95% of its time in routine A and you optimize some unrelated routine B that you thought was slow, well, you know, doesn't really matter how much faster you make it, no one's going to care. So you want to spend time where it matters. And so I strongly recommend that your first step when you have a real-world optimization task is use a tool to determine where the program spends time. And there are tools for this on every platform. On Linux, for example, there's a tool called perf. And I mean on Linux, this does not exist on OS X. OS X has these profilers, but they're different. So perf is what's known as a sampling profile. So it stops the program periodically and takes a look at where it stopped it, what's running, what functions are being called. And then it shows you those results, you know, to tell you what's going on. So this isn't perfect. Like, it may be the case that a function runs a lot and we never stop in the middle of it if we don't take enough samples. But it happens to be a nice, efficient way of implementing this. And I have a demo. So let's. So as an example for perf, let's say for using profiling, I have HCLRS. And if I run something like, say, you know, this infinite loop for 500,000 cycles, it takes a while. And maybe I want to make that faster. So what I'll do is I'll use my tool to record a profile. I'm going to pass some options. This call graph option says record not just the function you stop in, but what was calling it. And I'll also specify to take 5,000 samples a second. And I'll run the same with the right. So that runs for a while, and it says it took 75 samples in my program. And I can look at the result of that with a tool that perf comes with, perf report. And it shows me this chart, which is, has function names on the right side, and the program it was in, and this count children and self. So the children count says, when I took a sample, I was, you know, if I was in a function or in something called by a function, I add it to its children count. So for example, main here has 100% of its samples there because 100% of the samples were in things called by or in main. But 0% of the samples are in the self column. The self column is when I took the sample, you were executing instructions in this function proper. And at no time was I actually in main when it took a sample. Instead, it was in some function being called by main. So based on this, we can see that, you know, yeah, we spent a lot of time in main, but not in main proper. We were actually in this most of this time was spent in this function called by main called spanned expression evaluate. And that makes sense given what I have for, you know, what HTLRS does. And we can see furthermore that, you know, about 5% of the time was in this function that's part of HashMap. So it turns out that I only took 75 samples, and that means 5% is like a lot of my samples. So this is not actually very reliable. So for taking profiles like this, you want to get a larger number of samples. And I happen to have prepared something from earlier where I took a lot more samples. So we can get a better idea of what's going on. And we can see from here that, yes, I spend a lot of time in this evaluate function. And within that, one of the big things I'm spending time calling are these methods in HashMap, my standard library for the programming language I'm using, implementation of HashMap. And like that's not something I probably would have guessed looking at my code. Why am I spending lots of time looking things up in hash tables? And what's happening is that my expression evaluate keeps track of wire values in a hash table that's keyed by the name of the wire. And if this is telling me that looks like I'm spending, you know, like 25% of my time when I was running this code, looking up those names to find the value. And so that tells me that maybe if I want to make this faster, one thing I should think about is how can I replace that hash table with, say, just an array I look up an integer index instead of a string. No. And that's maybe not something that would have come up from reading the code naturally. So, yeah. So general pattern is you should use these profilers because you will discover something that you won't figure out reading the code. Also, these profilers can help you drill down. So this has an annotate mode where it shows me exactly where the samples happened with the assembly along with the corresponding source code. So like most of the, like the biggest 8.6% of the samples were on this line of code in HTLRS. This is Rust code, that's why it looks funny. It was like on these lines of code. Yeah?
Did you click on it so you get the part, or does it show you?
This is showing me the assembly. The assembly to code correspondence isn't exact because optimizations happened. So it's like not intuitive, unfortunately. But this is giving me, you know, an idea of exactly where the hotspots are. Okay, so that's about profilers. So I would hope, you know, the summary is please use a profiler if you do real world optimization because you won't be told smooth is slow. You'll be told this program is slow and it might not be what you think. And like for example, if it's file IO, you really don't want to have spent a lot of time making some computation faster and find out that, you know, it's still slow when you just wasted a couple weeks or something. Okay, so this is, that profile I showed you does sampling. There are other profiling techniques. For example, you can get exact counts. This is usually less good. And the main problem is that while you get nice counts, it gives you more information about what's happening. It has overhead, which is not even over the program. Sampling, like basically a fixed amount of time per second. But if we're counting like every time you call a function, well, that makes every function call slower. You know, which means that your overhead like is more about where you call functions. It becomes slower, which doesn't happen with a sampling profiler. But there's other kinds of profilers if you like want to know exactly how many times each function is called. Okay, so let's start with our next topic. You know, obviously we'll need to continue on that topic later, and that's exceptions. So let's say I have this loop here. I run this on a lab machine. Can you still use the lab machine? Who thinks yes? Yes, I could still use a lab machine, okay? And let's say the lab machine has one core. Who thinks yes, I can still use it? You know, if I'm running this code. Who thinks no? Okay, so the answer is yes. As you know, probably because people have accidentally written code with infinite loops and you could still log into the lab machine. So the question is, what's happening? Because if we look at the assembly for this, well, there's no instructions in the middle of this loop, and conceptually it should just keep running. And we can kind of measure this more exactly. So here I have a version of that code, but instead I time doing nothing. So I just get the time again. And if we were executing things like the processor you built for homework, you'd say, well, it should basically be a constant amount of time between each of these. Maybe there's some variation from like cache misses, but it should basically be the same amount of time every time if we were just always running. But if we actually measure that, this is the graph I get. So I have sample number, so I got the interval in time, and I have a log scale on the y-axis. So there are 7 orders of magnitude of difference or so. So the question is, what was happening here? You know, I was running my program, I was measuring the time, and instead of taking like 20 nanoseconds to do nothing, you know, execute like the instructions to store the time and that's it, I was taking milliseconds. And the key thing here is that this was a busy system. There's other programs, and there's only so many processors, and something else was using the processor under my back. That my loop was running, but something else got to run. So from my point of view, I had the CPU, I was running my loop program, kept running, and there was this break where, you know, I got the time, I stored it in my temporary variable, you know, which I'm using RBP for, and then there was a million cycle stall. You know, it's like my pipeline processor just has some random, really, really long stalls from my point of view. But what was really happening was that, you know, my system was busy, there were other programs that needed to run, and they got run. So my point of view, there was a million cycle stall, but in reality what happened is something else got to run on the processor. And this is good because, you know, I want my web browser to work while I'm running my infinite loop program. And, you know, this is kind of an oversimplified picture because it's not really the case that immediately SSH runs. Something needs to happen to make that occur. And what actually happens is that to make that occur, the operating system gets to run for a little bit of time. So my loop program was running, and then the operating system ran briefly and decided to start running SSH. Then SSH ran for a bit, then the operating system started running for some reason and decided, okay, I'm now gonna run Firefox. And then it said, then the operating system got to run again and then decided I'm gonna run loop. So the operating system, each time we switch between programs, gets to run a little bit, and it's responsible for both deciding what program do we run and actually starting the program, you know, making it start running. Of course, the question here is, how does the operating system run? And this is where we have exceptions. So exceptions are the mechanism the hardware has to start running the operating system without an actual function call. And the operating system basically has an exception handler, which is kind of like a function call made by the processor it called, and then it returns to do whatever it likes. So what the OS is doing is it gets run inside of a normal program by this hardware thing called exceptions, that saves the old program counter and all the registers somewhere. So it needs to save the old program counter because we want to start running the program in the same space again. You know, we want to have that million cycle delay happen. And we need to save all the registers because, well, the program isn't going to know when it's going to be interrupted. So we have to worry about every single register possibly being used. It's not like a function call where we can rely on specific registers being in, you know, good states. Because the program didn't prepare for this to happen. We're just interrupting it without regard to what it's doing. And this is called a context switch. And that's because the saved information, the stuff the OS is saving, is called a context. So it saves that information and it restores information for the program it wants to start running, like SSH. So it reads SSH's registers that it saved earlier and restores them. And that saved information, as I said, call the context. So this is where we'll pick up next time, talking about context and exceptions more generally. So that's what I have for today. Good luck on rotate. See you next week.